Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from some of our greatest writers whose books could be referred to as fantasy or speculative fiction or any or all manner of labels that don't quite get it right. The event took place in 2016 at Wordstock, Portland's book festival. And what I love about Wordstock is that we get to explore all genres of literature and bring together writers who share common themes or preoccupations, or conversely, do not agree on much at all. The panel was broadly titled Dark Magic and explores how and why magic plays a role in each of their literary works. Our panelists include the international best-selling writer P.C. Cast and two writers at the relative beginning of their career, Renee Adia and Kendari Blake. The event was moderated by Portland's own National Book Award finalist, Lainey Taylor. What this conversation does, with so much humor and warmth, is remind us of the sheer audacity of the imaginations of these writers. As each describes their work, it's easy to feel exhilarated by the sheer size of their imaginative acts and intrigued by the influences and inspirations behind these books. Here's our moderator, Lainey Taylor.
I am very pleased to introduce these three awesome authors here for our Dark Magic panel. I'm going to start right here on my right with Renee Adia, who is a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In her spare time, she likes to dance salsa and collect shoes. She's passionate about all kinds of curry, rescue dogs, and college basketball. The first few years of her life were spent in a high-rise in South Korea. Consequently, Renee enjoys having her head in the clouds. She lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, with her husband and their tiny overlord of a dog. Her latest book, The Rose and the Dagger, is the sequel to her sparkling debut novel, The Wrath and the Dawn. And next is Kendari Blake, who stores more movie trivia in her head than anything else. Cast lists, weird behind-the-scene facts, often even of films she's never seen, which totally, when you hear that, doesn't it like make you want to challenge her and try to stump her? It's kind of a problem, but it helps out when playing 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. She lives in Kent, Washington, with her two dogs, cat and husband, and is the author of Anna Dressed in Blood and the recently released dark fantasy Three Dark Crowns. And on the far side is P.C. Cast, who is a number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author and a member of the Oklahoma Writers Hall of Fame, and is a 3 years recent Oregon transplant. With more than 20 million copies in print in over 40 countries, her novels have been awarded the prestigious Oklahoma Book Award, Yalsa Quick Picks for Reluctant Readers, Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award, The Prism, Holt Medallion, Daphne du Maurier, Bookseller's Best, and The Laurel Wreath.
Never the National Book Award, though. Just saying.
PC was born in the Midwest and grew up being shuttled back and forth between Illinois and Oklahoma, which is where she fell in love with quarter horses and mythology. After high school, she joined the United States Air Force and began public speaking and writing. After her tour in the Air Force, she taught high school for 15 years before retiring to write full-time. PC lives in Oregon, surrounded by beloved cats, dogs, horses, and family. Moon Chosen is her latest novel. I sense a real pet theme, an animal theme among all three of you. You all mentioned your animals. You all have dogs, yeah? And I'm Lainey Taylor, and I'm the author of the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy and the forthcoming Strange the Dreamer, which the advanced copies just came out this week, so I'm very excited. And I live here in Portland, Oregon, and thank you all for coming to this great event. I would love it if you guys could each tell us a little bit about your new book or your current series. Whoever would like to start.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Lainey. I'm Renee Adia. I'm the author of The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger. The Rose and the Dagger is the recently released sequel to The Wrath and the Dawn. So if you're one of these people like me who is looking for instant gratification, this is a completed series. And it is a reimagining of the Arabian Nights. It's the story of Scheherazade. It has some nods to The Count of Monte Cristo, as well as Beauty and the Beast. So if you like books about scimitars and swirling sands and girls who are trying to kill you, this is the book for you.
Hi, I'm Kendara Blake, and my new book is called Three Dark Crowns, and it is set on a magical, isolated island. And it is on this island, it always has a queen, and the queen always has triplet girls, and unfortunately for them on this island, well, there's only one crown, so when they turn 16, they've got a year to just, like, off each other, and whichever sister survives gets to take over.
Aw. Hi, I'm PC Cast. This is the first book in my new series, my new fantasy series, which is a big departure from House of Night, those of you who might know me from House of Night. It is set here in Portland, post-ecological apocalypse. You guys, I destroy every bridge in Portland. Just saying. And the Portlandia statue is worshipped as a god, as well she should be. Most of it is set outside Sabi. People live in the trees, they photosynthesize, and of course, you know, here we have a lot of trees, okay, big trees. And there's a huge pet element in this too, and anyone from Portland's gonna have a lot of hee-hee-hee-hee as you're reading this. I think you'll enjoy it.
I definitely did, and I thought the island was probably Sobe.
It's Sobe, yeah.
All right. Yeah. Very cool. I would love to know from each of you where the idea for your series came from. What was the initial seed? How it evolved, and like, what was it about this particular idea that made you commit to it?
About four years ago, I had a stalker. I had a major security problem, and I was afraid all the time. And my family and I talked, and I decided to get a personal protection dog. A huge Eastern European German Shepherd. But it was my relationship with him that I've always had dogs, cats, horses, raised on a ranch. I'd never had a working dog before, and I'd never had a German Shepherd. And it was a life-altering experience. Not only did he make me feel safe all the time, he was with me for a year. I did not leave my house unless he came with me. And the bond that he and I formed, it was insta-love. Like no other, okay? It was like a Romeo and Juliet without the sex and death. It was so fabulous. So about 4 years ago, I started thinking about, he made me think about Anne McCaffrey, Pern, right? And bonding, and that's what started this. I wanted to create a world where humans and canines could bond on an emotional and a physiological level, and that means the canines live 40 to 50 years. Yes. Yeah. So that's how I came up with this. And then wherever I live, the land always really informs my writing. And I moved here 3 years ago when I started working on this. So for real, started working on it, not just brainstorming. So that's how that happened.
That is so sweet. So Three Dark Crowns actually also has an Oregon beginning. Not that, I mean, the magical island that it's set on is completely fictional. It's not Oregon. But I was at a book event in the Dalles a couple years ago, like 3 years ago. And it was a really cool book event. It was actually one that Lainey and I, we were just talking about at Clint's Booksellers, which is one of the oldest bookstores in the country. And they do a really cool event in the spring. They bring in a bunch of YA authors, and they open up their back lot. And they bring in, like, a hot dog truck, which is so important. And,
what? Hot dog truck?
Like, the kids, they have some local kids, like, playing music and doing skits, and there's art and everything. But that year, there was this ball of bees in this tree right next to the hot dog truck, like a literal bee of like ball about the size of a half a basketball. So of course we were all afraid, like the kids are going to get stung, everyone's going to die, the bees are coming for us, we need to shut this down. But as luck would have it, there was a beekeeper on staff that day.
Okay.
And she wasn't on staff, she was just like a guest that day. And she's like, don't worry, they're swarming. In the middle of that ball is a queen bee. And as long as you don't spray them with water or poke them with sticks, they're gonna stay in that ball and not bother anybody. So the event went off, nobody got stung, everything was fine, nobody squirted the bees with ketchup or anything. But I was like, that is fascinating to me, beekeeper woman. So I like chased her around and I'm like, why? Why is she in the middle of a ball? Is that how she has to travel every time? Just like, come thousands of my children, get on me, I wanna go to the market. So I started, And eventually, after all of my questioning, she told me, no, she must have had a reason to leave the old hive, and before she did, she probably laid her queen eggs. So 4 or 5 queen eggs, and these new queen daughters will hatch out, murder each other, and whichever one lives gets to take over the old hive. And I thought, lovely, nature. And the whole time I was driving home from this event, I was just thinking how much I wanted to do that to people. And that's where this book came from.
Not dark at all. That's awesome. I love all of these origin stories because I feel like you can hear not only where people get the ideas, but you get such a great, such wonderful insight into seeds of inspiration in general, because it could just be, like, I joke with people, you could be driving by a field of corn, and authors always take things entirely too far. We don't stop at that what-if question. Like, what if the corn were sentient? And then it's gone. But we give the corn names, we give them agendas, we give them, like, these, like, post-apocalyptic worlds. It's great, right? So for me, with The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger, probably the reason that I wrote this is twofold. The first being that I am the child of mixed race. And when I was growing up, I didn't see myself in books that often. So I knew when I wanted to start writing books, I wanted to bring a different world to life. And the world, the inspiration for The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger is it's ancient Persia. It's right at that cusp between the Abbasid Caliphate and the Sassanid Empire. And the reason I did this is because the story of Scheherazade, pardon my bad Dr. Seuss moment, is the Persian version of Beauty and the Beast. So, and I thought to myself, okay, so this is a tale that's incredibly familiar to Western readers, to Western audiences. And if I took the story of Scheherazade and turned it into a YA book, what would that look like? And I remember the moment when I really decided I wanted to do this. It was when I was visiting my in-laws. My husband's family is Persian, which is why I have that name with all the H's. And whenever I went to their house, I noticed on the wall a tapestry that sort of like at a distance looked like like 100 different vignettes strung together at random. And I asked my mother-in-law, what is this? And she told me it was the stories from 1001 Nights. And I just began reading, and I read several different versions, like translated versions of 1001 Nights, because the stories that we know, like Aladdin, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, Sinbad, those are actually culled from the oral traditions of many different cultures throughout the East. So if you think about the story of Cinderella, that's actually an ancient Chinese story, as is the original story of Aladdin. It's really fascinating when you look back and you see the inspiration from the eastern part of the world, and you just think all of these stories are you know, based in what we currently see as the Middle East, and it's actually from eastern traditions all over. And I thought, well, this is an excellent way to ruin my life, because I'm just the research. I'm a huge research sort of person, and I also learned how to make all the food that's in this book. I set fire to my kitchen making Persian rice. I'll tell you guys that story later.
So for you, was part of the spark of the story the question of how could Scheherazade fall in love with this madman, or what could be different in my version versus in the original story? I mean,
absolutely, because it's sort of like glossed over because it's a frame narrative. Scheherazade is the one who's telling all of these stories in the original 1001 Nights. She's telling all these stories to this murderous king who has been inexplicably taking a new bride every night and having her killed at dawn. So Scheherazade tries to break this cycle by volunteering to marry the king and by starting a story at night and then leaving it on a cliffhanger at dawn. And so he can't kill her. And over the course of 1001 nights, they have kids, and he falls in love. And to me, it seemed a little bit convenient, because, like, how could you just fall in love with somebody who's been inexplicably murdering women? I mean, that's a monster. And there was no real backstory to any of that. And I wanted to explore that a little bit and sort of see, because I love spaces of gray. I love working in moral gray. And these impossible questions, like, what would you do if faced with this situation? Crappy choice here.
So we have 3 very different worlds and premises: a post-apocalyptic Portland in which humanity has split into tribes with different physical and magical strengths and weaknesses, a magical goddess-worshipping island where every generation triplet queens must fight each other to death for the crown, and a fantastic reimagining of the story of Scheherazade from the 1001 Nights. But this panel topic is dark magic, and they all have that in common. Can you talk about the role that magic plays in your books and how you developed your magical systems?
I like my magic to be based on biology, because that's how I found magic, is my dad awakened magic to my life around when I was 9. He gave me Lord of the Rings, and my dad's a biologist, a biology teacher. Actually, I taught with him for 10 years. He and I taught at the same school for 10 years before he retired. So because I have such a strong background in biology, I have a dual minor accidentally, because biology's just always been really easy for me. So I took a bunch of biology electives with a bunch of pre-med people, and wasn't lost. I liked it. I like to base my magic on earth elements. So as with House of Night, but more in this, there's way more earth to it. And my magic always has to have, it has to have some kind of element of biology to it. Like there's sun and there's moon worshipped in here. And also that you can, not me personally, but my characters can channel those elements and the magic from those elements. And so I don't do like Harry Potter magic where, boom, you're a mouse. I do more like hooking into the tree that's going to call to the mouse, or better yet, squirrel, and bring it there. So mine will always be very heavy in biology and also in matriarchy.
Yes, the matriarchy.
Yes.
Three Dark Crowns is obviously set in a matriarchy. That was important to me. But the magic, The magic, so on the island, the magic is called gifts, and you can have one of any number of gifts. The three main gifts on the island are now naturalists, who can make things grow, like the harvest, and they also have a cute little animal familiar, kind of like a demon from the Golden Compass. Or you can be an elemental, so you can control one or all of the elements. The oldest triplet sister, Mirabella, can actually control them all, which is insanely rare, and she's extremely strong. So everybody thinks she's going to win. Or you can be a poisoner. So you can ingest any toxin without becoming ill, and you're also really good at mixing and creating new poisons to kill people in lovely and interesting ways. So I don't know. I mean, when I think of magic, I usually go more like a... Yeah, kind of like from the earth, very like a Wiccan kind of, that's where it comes from. I guess nobody uses wands in mine either. I didn't even think of wands. I kind of want them now.
Anyway, the magic in my system, I'd say a lot of the inspiration for magic in my system, it's a little more nebulous, I would say. And I think it's because the writing that I love is often magical realism. I'm a big fan of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a big fan of Isabel Allende. So I love that sort of sparkle of magic that's just peppered throughout a narrative. And with The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger, because I really wanted to explore this idea of choice and consequence, I really wanted to make having powers, being able to do magic, have very clear consequences. Because for me, that's the stuff that sort of propels the narrative, the conflict of consequences. And I wanted to make the magic, especially the dark magic in The Wrath and the Dawn, be or almost like sacrificial. So in order to wield this dark magic, you have to take a life, whether it's the life of a small creature, a life of a human being, and obviously that will affect the level of power you have, the things that you can do. And I really wanted to explore with these books, Scheherazade's father is the one, or Scheherazade in my book, Shazi. Her dad is the one who has sort of his entire life been able to do little magic things, not anything of significance, he's actually not that great at it, but in an attempt to sort of rescue his daughter, he tries to acquire greater power through a book. Again, power of words, the power of story, they're very meaningful to me and very important in terms of theme with these books. And I really wanted him, when he was exploring this, trying to get power, to sort of lose his way. And it be as a result of the fact that he starts by, you know, killing these small animals so he can take their, it's like a blood magic, he can take their life source and and channel it into power. And he's trying to do it to save his daughter initially, but then, of course, things go awry, as they often do in stories.
Okay, so which magic from your own book would you wish to have?
I have been asked this a lot, so I've put a lot of thought into it. I'm really scared of poison, so I don't want...
I was going to say, please don't be a poisoner.
Good God, it's like, no, it's so scary.
It's like the grossest, worst gift. I don't know how you came up with that. It's like oh, like reading it, it's like, oh, you can't, like...
I read, although I do love to eat, so, like, if I could eat without ever being worried about being poisoned, that might be just fine.
How many people
are you really worried about being poisoned, though? Are you, like, out places and you're like, I'm going
to
be poisoned?
Like, even food poisoning, you just wouldn't be able to get it. I'd just be like, this is questionable. I don't care. I'm fine. I'm going to be okay.
Sometimes it's worth it. Like, you travel, sometimes it's worth it. I'm like, whatever.
Okay, I'm sorry. So, not a poisoner then.
Not a poisoner. I guess I would be, like, a naturalist. And not because I want the animal familiar, which I do. But I probably wouldn't get the one I wanted. I'd get, like, a beaver. Like, he just, because you don't get the one you want, you get the one you get. And he'd be, like, large and belligerent. And I'd have to, like, push him around in a cart everywhere. But... also related to food, you know, naturalists can ripen everything, and sometimes you just don't want to wait for guacamole. I would never wait for guacamole again. Like, ripe!
It's a good point.
So, Kendara is just hungry.
I am. Yeah, I hear it.
Well, you know, actually, I love the idea of an animal familiar. This is one of my, you know, so I love that you both have that in your books, and it's definitely, like, I love that you mentioned Anne McCaffrey, because I thought of the Dragon Riders of Pern. I thought of, I don't know how many of you guys, and also Philip Pullman and the Golden Compass. Those are like two of my, like, I wish I wrote that and I wish it was true. Like, because I want a demon and I also want a dragon to imprint on me. So I'm sure we probably all feel the same way. And how many of you guys have, like, not spent any time thinking what your demon would be?
Crickets. We've all done it.
Right. And another one of my, you know, things that I would love to have is a flying carpet. So
yeah,
was that wish fulfillment?
It was totally wish fulfillment. I mean, come on, the idea of being able to fly in any story is wish fulfillment. I was actually debating, though, because I'm also a big weapons nerd. I love to study different swords. I love to study different, like, bows and arrows. And in writing this book, I did the research in terms of I actually went to like, have somebody teach me falconry. And I really wanted to do mounted archery, too. But unfortunately, you have to demonstrate some level of prowess with either, or not either, with both before they actually let you get on a horse. But I feel like I'm constantly thwarted, because for my next series, it's set in a fantasy feudal Japan, so I took kendo lessons. They will never let you use a blade. Like, you're still using the wooden sword. You have to, again, demonstrate a level of proficiency. And I'm like, oh, thwarted.
You can do it at home.
That's true. My husband's like, no, she cannot do this at home.
Do you have, like, a weapons dungeon?
No. But I do, every time I go to a different country, I collect a dagger from
you
that
do.
Different country.
How
I
many do you have?
I have 8 right now.
Do you know all the, like, names for them?
And yes, their... yes. So, yeah, it's really cool.
I have from... The sword that the caliph has in The Wrath and the Dawn is a shamshir? Is that what it's
called? Shamshir,
yeah. So it's such a cool word.
Yeah, and it's the Persian word for, like, essentially what they would use as a scimitar. It's not the same thing, too. But my digression was a result of me saying that I was sort of torn between being able to use a flying carpet or be able to, we have a like, sort of a bodyguard character in The Wrath and the Dawn. His name is the Rajput. And the Rajput has a talvar, which is, it's a Hindustani sword, and he can set fire to it. And I was like, that would be awesome.
Oh, here comes Renee with her flaming sword.
Lainey's like rolling her eyes. Oh God, not again.
No, that would be super awesome, but a little bit, you know.
Kendara would be like, I'm all right with it.
That would be good. Like, why not combine the two and come in on a flying carpet?
Oh,
with the flaming sword.
I feel like the wind would not work with me.
Like, right? I feel like the wind would
Renee,
not work
with me. What happens to your eyebrows?
The flaming hair, the carpet. It would be a badass entrance, but it would be one.
It'd be a one-time. One-time thing.
So what would yours be?
I think I want all my animal familiars, because I have the dogs, I have shepherds and terriers, because guess what? I have shepherds and terriers. Mm-hmm. And then I have lynx familiars, because I have that crazy Maine Coon. And in the third book, we're going to the plains of the Wind Riders. Yeah, so I get to put my horses in there. So I want all of them.
All of it. You just want all of it.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah.
All right, fair enough. How about the moon powers and the...
Well, I'm assuming that I'm going to be a moon woman, and so I want those powers, too.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. But she's not greedy or anything. Yeah. Okay, and Kendara, if you could choose your animal familiar and it didn't have to be a beaver, what would it be?
Oh, an
I mean, would it be a mountain lion?
Like, okay, so if you guys haven't spent time thinking about what your demon would be from the Golden Compass, has anybody found their Patronus on Pottermore?
Yeah. Yes.
Has anybody in this audience found their Patronus?
Like, I am so bitter about my Patronus
what
on Pottermore.
What is it?
Okay, it can't. I don't think it's worse than mine.
The Dementors will laugh with glee.
What is it?
Like, okay, I'm like
a dark
rabbit?
Person. Okay,
is it a bunny?
It's a field mouse.
Oh my god! All right. So aside from dark magic, the books also have in common. Okay, the term is problematic, but I'm going to use it anyway. Strong female characters. Shazi in The Wrath and the Dawn, Mari and her mother in Moon Chosen, and the three queens and their female friends and family, lots of strong female characters in Three Dark Crowns. They're all very different, and they all rise to the occasion in very different ways. And I would love to, well, there's been a lot of discussion about this term, strong female character, and I'd love to hear what it means to you and how you go about writing a woman or girl who owns her own story and the idea of power in your stories.
I totally see it, and I hear you about it being fraught, because to me, I get frustrated when people talk about strong female characters, because I don't actually set out to write strong female characters. I set out to write interesting characters, well-rounded characters, regardless of their gender. I think it's important to have, it's a writer's responsibility to their story and to his or her readers to create and craft these worlds that are multifaceted and layered, and you have to do that with your characters too. And I really wanted, with The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger, with Shahrzad, to explore different kinds of strength in characters. Because I often think that in YA, I love characters like Katniss. I love these bow and arrow wielding characters. But that's just one kind of strength. And our idea of strength is so centered on the male notion of strength, like the ability to like kill things, provide, that kind of thing. And there's like strength of the heart, there's strength of the mind, and I feel like it's important to explore these characters. It's not just in your female characters, but in your male characters as well.
I love that. Kill things, provide.
Like, yeah, bop, yeah, exactly.
Bring
that's
home.
It. Exactly.
I do good.
I win. I'm strong.
Oh, it's perfect.
Yeah, so Kendara, you have so many female characters in your book. Was it difficult to make them unique and distinct? And
that was fun. It was so much fun to work in a matriarchy. And the matriarchy is not like, it's just that's the way it was. Since the idea came from a beehive, which is a matriarchy itself, it just kind of lent itself to that idea. And it was great to work with female characters who never had any kind of gender expectations put on them. But the thing about the strong female character, I wasn't interested in like writing a matriarchy to make a point. I just wanted to put women in power positions and have it just be that's the way it is. Men accepted it, women accepted it, no big deal. I wanted to create characters who were real, because you know, women are all strong and we're all also weak and we're smart and we're stupid. Sometimes the same thing at different points in our day. So I wanted them to make bad choices. I wanted them to have their weaknesses, you know. I just like to throw things at characters and see how it changes them for the good or the bad.
Did you have a favorite character to write?
I thought I would, but they all, no.
All right.
Like, yeah, I ended up enjoying them all.
I love writing strong female characters. I think that there's another aspect, though, that is also equally as important as the character herself, is how she interacts with other women in your world. Some people might think that if your heroine has friends, close friends, that somehow abhorrent or somehow not normal. I think part of writing a strong, like a matriarchal novel or a novel with strong female characters is also showing that a strong woman uplifts other women around her and does not tear them down. And so you're not going to get a bunch of bickering females and strangeness like that in my books. I think that is equally as important as creating your heroine, as creating your heroine's tribe. And so I spent a lot of time on creating her tribe. And when you first start reading my series, you'll think, oh, I don't like her. God, she's so hateful and shallow. And then by the end of the book, you're like, oh my God, she's my favorite character. I did it on purpose because, like we were talking about it, there's, you know, you're smart and stupid at the same time, sometimes one right after the other one or right before the other one. And I like to create multidimensional characters that are all interacting in a healthy manner or in a manner that moves towards being healthy as they mature in my series.
Right, and I think that, like, as readers, we tend to be more forgiving of male protagonists who portray
Absolutely.
The exact same flaws, where in a female protagonist, it'd be like bookending for you. Yeah. Like, we're just like,
wait,
oh, bleh,
are you suggesting there's a double standard?
What?
No. Of course not.
How dare you? No. Well, I love what you said about, you know, different kinds of strength. And there was something, it was a few years ago, do you guys remember when the Disney Cinderella live action movie came out? There was a lot of talk on Twitter from some authors too, who I really respect, who were just trashing Cinderella for being like this milquetoast, weak character. And I really, like, I had never sort of thought I would ever rise in defense of Cinderella, because I agree, in most stories she is, but I thought that the way she was depicted in the story, she was very strong, but she wasn't Katniss. Like, there was no way a character in that context could have fought or defended herself in any way, but she had found a kind of strength as a survivor, and I thought that was a really interesting kind of strong character to portray, and so I found myself sort of, you know, feeling, I don't know, like really questioning the idea of a strong female character. And I actually just looked it up on Wikipedia when I was like writing this question, like, what? And I thought, or looked it up on Google, and the first thing was Wikipedia, where it's, I love that it did this, it said, strong female character is a stock character type, the opposite of the damsel in distress. And it is like just as sort of meaningless as and empty as the damsel in distress, and as unrealistic, but to the opposite extreme. And I do love the idea of writing a multitude of characters who, you know, not everyone can fight and can defend themselves. And so I think it's really important to show those kind of multidimensional characters. And like Mari certainly doesn't start out as you know, anyone you would expect to be able to defend herself.
I love maturing them. I love having them grow and change through the books. And yeah. That's, I also love surprising my audience, you know, by creating a, I love creating a character and I'm like, they're going to hate her at first. And then I'm going to make them love her. Yeah, I like that.
I didn't hate anybody at first, certainly. But
well, Sora, a lot, I've heard, Sora is, comes off as pretty shallow okay. at first and everything. And she's, you find out she's absolutely not. But it's, I like doing that too.
I really love too turning a perceived weakness in a character into a strength. I yeah. love doing that because with Shazzy, she's kind of headstrong and reckless.
Kind of.
Yeah, kind of, seriously. She's kind of headstrong and reckless. I mean, she goes to the palace intent on getting revenge on this boy king who has been murdering girls inexplicably. And unfortunately, her closest friend, Shazzy's closest friend, falls victim to this. And so she goes to the palace with this idea of, I'm going to get revenge, and really hasn't thought it through past that. So it's just this idea of this very one-track mind, very black and white perception of the world. And it's interesting to turn that into, because I would see that as absolutely being a weakness, somebody who can't step back from the picture, create a plan, who just kind of barrels ahead thoughtlessly. But it works for her. It really works for her. And it works for her because it's this idea of loyalty, this idea of love, absolute love. It really propels her story.
So, to shift gears a little bit, I'm still trying to find the secret easy way to write a book without half killing yourself. Do you know it? And will you please tell us?
Who has the secret?
Which I guess is another way of saying, how do you write a book? What's it like for you?
Oh, boy.
Are you in a fugue state and you can't remember? You just, like, wake up and there's a manuscript on your desk?
It comes in my dreams. No, never.
You're okay. Taking dictation
never.
From the muse.
God, wouldn't that be amazing?
I'm just the conduit, right? It just flows through my fingers. Actually, I usually have a main premise, and I love research, too. Love research. And just on the 20th, my daughter and I are going to Wales to research for the last couple weeks in this month to research our new YA paranormal series, The Disasters, that'll be out next year. And I can hardly wait.
You're writing two series at once? Stop it. Three. It's not fair. See, yeah. She does know the secret. She's just not going to tell us.
I'm
super guilty right now. I don't know. I can see
it's
it.
The
I'm also writing a surprise House of Night book for next right. year. No, my publisher doesn't even know. I haven't even told him.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Three series and a surprise book.
Just surprise like, book. Surprise book.
She's holding out. Okay, what is the secret?
I come up with a premise. And then I have like the beginning and the end. And then all this crazy stuff happens in the middle. So it's like this. I plot it from here, and it's supposed to go from here to here. And what happens is it goes from here, zing, zing, and then it changes, and it finally meanders over here. But for the first half of the book, God, it's so awful. Oh, my God. I would so rather wash my cat than write. But I think that the trick is not stopping. That's been my trick. I just keep like, it's like a roller coaster that goes like, that's the whole up until like, oh, this book was 747 manuscript pages. Ugh. So they just would not stop talking. About by page 300 or so, 300, 350 was when I finally hit the top. And once I hit the top, then writing is the best job in the world. Because it goes like this. Whoosh. I go from writing, struggling to write 5 pages a day, to writing between 15 and 25 daily. In the last, when I get it, I don't know what it is. It's like this magic point. And I think I've written like 37 books now or something, and it happens in every book. I know it's a lot of books, right? Every book, it's so horrible in the beginning, then just something switches. So my magic pill is just don't stop.
So I really am asking, because I'm about to start a new book, because I just finished Strange the Dreamer, and it was a really difficult process, and I'm not somebody who cannot stop. Like, I have, my brain is just not my friend. It's like, you will stop and rewrite this paragraph, or you'll die. Basically, like, this is the worst thing ever written, and if you don't go back, like, something dire will happen. It's really, I mean, there's all different kinds of brains, and like, I try to do that, and I'm gonna try again, because I think that sounds really sane and awesome. But how about you guys? Can you write a fast first draft? Does that work for you?
I can, I think for me, it's all about the preparation, and I think it's all about giving myself permission to suck. Like giving myself, like looking at the words on the page and being like, okay, that's terrible, move along. And before I begin writing a book, because I'm a very character-driven author, I'll do all of my research, and then I'll take all these blank sheets of white paper and I'll put a character's name in the center of it. So for instance, Shahrzad from The Wrath and the Dawn, I'll put her name in the center, put a circle around it, and put a bunch of lines around it, and think about character traits I'd like for Shahrzad to embody. So I'd want Shahrzad to be brave. And so I want to construct a scene that shows rather than tells that Shahrzad is brave. And I'll do this with every single character, and I'll craft scenes around this character's journey. And then I'll start to put the scenes in chronological order. And often I'll see that there's overlap or redundancies, throw those out, and I'll be able to string along a narrative that's framed around these characters' growth and their character arc. And the top of every single page, I will tell myself for each of these characters, what does this character ultimately want? What is going to thwart this character's journey? So you keep that with every single character. And for me, it really helps to craft something that I think is clean. Like, usually my first drafts are kind of short, and then I flesh them out later. I put it on the world building. I make the words pretty. But I really had to get to a place where I was okay with writing something really at first, where it was just like, even if it was like place marker, excellent kissing scene here, not today. But like, you know, like, gonna cheer yourself on and tell yourself it is okay to be bad, because our first drafts, I mean, readers get like these drafts that have gone through, like, I have tons of like friends who read for me, like beta readers who give amazing notes, through my editor, through copy editors, through line editors. This thing has gone through the ringer like 10, 11, 12 times. The first thing we put out on the page is not, I mean, at least for me, it's not great.
I mean, I don't, like, I do that, but scene by scene or chapter by chapter. Like, I have not, like, my perfectionism does not allow me to like if I keep going too long in that way, like I lose my investment in the book and I have to go back. Like I have to, like I have to build it as I go. But like, but yeah, the first, so I'll do a chapter or a chunk of chapters like until I, and so I never end up having a whole draft like that. And I mean, so not that this is like awesome, but everybody's, you know, everybody's brain works really differently and you just have to figure out what works. And then also know that that can change over your life and you can try to change it. So, and maybe have more time to do other things besides write.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. I'm so lazy. I will be long dead before I finish 37 books. And I will be long dead before I ever do any of that character mapping and research. Like, there is a reason I'm never going to write hard sci-fi, and that's because I don't want to know how gravity works. Like, I don't want to know, like, the stuff that you need on a spaceship. That Martian, the Martian movie, I'm like, Matt Damon, just let it go, just die. Just eat what you got, just eat it all in one day, and then just die. So,
oh my God. And can you imagine the human race if it was, you know, just run by fantasy writers?
A very bloody place.
Exciting. Very bloody. It's basically going to be like Game of Thrones. It's going to be Westeros.
I don't know, but on the other hand, I'm always sort of thinking, like, the fantasy writer in me is always also thinking of, like, salvation scenarios, too. Like, it's hard to go through a year like we've had now without, like, this part of your brain is just automatically trying to solve the problem in a fantasy matrix like you would for one of your books. Like, there must be something that can swoop in and save us right now. All right, well, we have 10 minutes left, so I think I meant to open it up to questions a little bit sooner, but here we are, and I would love to invite you guys to ask questions. There's a microphone up here if you want to come up.
Hi. I have a question based off of something that PC said. The idea of a Mary Sue, I think, is just recently kind of figured out. When I was younger in high school, I thought, oh, she's such a Mary Sue, she's such an awful character. But now we see characters like Rey in Star Wars who are really well-written, really well-formed characters being accused of being Mary Sues. And how do you see this going in the future of writing women who are wonderfully well-rounded characters but still being accused of being shallow or just not well-written or overpowered in some way? And how do you think we can fight against this, like, deluge of negativity?
Girl, it's the patriarchy, okay?
Oh, I know. I didn't see a single woman call Rey a Mary Sue.
They don't call... I mean, think of the male characters that we grew up reading. How many of those would be Mary Sue's?
Yeah, I mean, the
all
idea
they have
that
to do is be likable and have friends.
And be capable. That's
and be capable.
The capable.
And
yeah.
Capable
with
female
Rey,
character is so unrealistic. Yeah. Oh my God, Rey, like she can actually do things and she doesn't need a guy to save her.
Well, like, look at the mirror too, because she's a direct parallel to Luke Skywalker. I'm a huge like Star Wars fan. Mm-hmm. Luke was like naturally gifted at basically all the same things that Rey is naturally. And no one's accusing him. It wasn't a thing in the 70s to accuse somebody of being a Gary Stu. Like, yeah. That's not what's happening. So I think I totally agree with PC. I think it's the patriarchy and the
just
idea that women can't be good at stuff.
Just write them, you know? We'll get that many out there. And then, like, come on. Like, Indiana Jones is a rogue paleontologist who's so friggin' charming and, you know. Like,
he's so Mary Sue.
He's so okay. A Gary Sue. And I love him. I mean, who cares? So just write them and we'll love them and people will just come around.
And ladies, we need to support this, too. We don't need to like, buy into that garbage. And like, if you're reviewing someone, even if it's just on Amazon or if it's on Goodreads or something, don't buy into that crap. If it's a strong female character and she's likable and capable and cool and has friends, don't pick at her. Don't do what too often young women do to each other. Support each other and lift each other up and get rid of the patriarchy.
And also realize, too, that haters are going to hate regardless. Yeah. I mean, like, one of my favorite reviews, and I send it always to my friends whenever they get really down about whether it be Goodreads reviews or something like that. I will look at it, too, when I have had, like, a bad day with reviews. It's a review of the movie Happy Feet. It's on Amazon. It's a 1-star review. Below it, it says, penguins shouldn't talk. People will find a reason to hate anything. Just accept it.
That's awesome.
That is so offensive.
That's a great question, though.
Thank you so much.
I was just wondering, as a person who really enjoys writing, but doesn't always enjoy sharing it for, you know, just fear that it's not great, when you write, is your writing more plot-driven or character-driven, and does one or the other predominantly help you in getting from point A to point Z with your books?
Character, total character-driven. Yeah, they do shit all the time. I have no clue they're going to do. And they mess up my whole plot, and I just go with it. And then crazy stuff happens, and it works out.
Plot informs character. Character informs plot. So I really think you can't have one without the other. That being said, earlier on, I said I was more of a character-driven author because when I'm plotting, I will begin with the character's drives and motivation. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on how you think of plot. I mean, there are a lot of just completely character-driven novels where not a lot happens.
Right.
Like, you know, like Catcher in the Rye, what does he really do? It's just more about, like, the internalization of Holden Caulfield's and, you know, whatever that is. Phonies. You're just all phonies. It just depends. There are no real, you know, rules to writing.
Okay.
When you're doing it, you just, like, definitely do it for yourself. And if you love it, somebody else out there is going to love it, too.
Why do you guys want to be authors?
People inside my head wouldn't shut up. And so in first grade, I wrote my first book, Blubby the Blue Whale. It hasn't been published yet.
For me, it was because I loved books so much and stories so much as a kid. And when it occurred to me that there were people got to do that for their job, it was just, you know, absolutely, that was all I really ever wanted to do.
I wrote when I was a kid because I moved here and I didn't speak English, and my grandmother gave me her entire collection of Nancy Drew books. The first thing I ever wrote really was Nancy Drew fan fiction. I didn't want to be a writer because both of my parents were artists. Both of my parents are musicians. And they really dissuaded us from pursuing anything creative because they're like, you're always going to be poor. You're always going to be poor. You're always going to be struggling. And they wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. So I wanted to be a lawyer. And now I'm a writer because I enjoy all kinds of storytelling.
all of these things, you know, you love reading, and it just kind of like informs it. And I get really cranky if I don't write. Like, I've tried to walk away numerous times, like, but I can't quit it. Like, it's like the Ennis to my Jack. I just can't. So it's, if I go without 2 weeks, I'll just start getting really irritable.
Do you feel guilty too? I feel real guilty.
I don't, but my husband will start being like, what is with you?
Yeah.
Like, go back to your office hole.
I mean, yeah, I'm irritable too, because I don't have any channel for it, all of these things.
I feel like crap. I'm always like, and I'm always like, man, and you realize, oh man, I better go back to my cave.
Yeah. Okay, guys, I'm afraid we are out of time. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Thank you so much, guys.
That was a conversation featuring PC Cast, Renee Adia, and Kandari Blake from Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2016. The Wordstock 2017 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 11th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.